Well, we're in this series called Text, where we're talking about the Bible, this sacred text that for a lot of us has a lot of meaning and really drives what we believe and drives part of our journey of faith. But last week we introduced a thorny question as we're thinking about this book. And the question was this: is the text reliable? Is it trustworthy? Is it dependable? Can we actually believe it? And does the things that it says happened actually happen? Now, it's a very complex question for a few reasons, because for starters, there are lots of parts of the Bible that aren't meant to be taken literally or historically or even scientifically. Jesus told stories. He told a story about a prodigal son. But we all recognize it was just a story. There wasn't an actual prodigal son. He was telling a story to make an illustration. So it wasn't meant to be taken historically. And then, of course, there are lots of parts of the Bible that are more poetic in nature, or they use figures of speech. For example, the Bible in places talks about the sun rising and setting. And we all, and in fact, we still use that language today when we talk about sunrise and sunset, but we all know that the sun doesn't actually rise and the sun doesn't actually set. The earth just rotates so that we can see the sun or not see it. So it's a figure of speech, or there's poetic language there. And we realize it wasn't meant to be taken scientifically or literally or historically. And so we've got to keep that in mind. And yet there are parts of the Bible that do seem to be meant that way. In the Old Testament, there's the long narrative about the history of Israel, where it seems like there really was this group of people and there was this nation and they were delivered from slavery in Egypt and they settled into the promised land. And then they had this history, and they have kings and battles, and their stories about their agricultural practices and their customs and their society and all those kinds of things. And it seems like these were meant to be historically true and accurate. And archaeology, believe it or not, demonstrates that these stories really are true and accurate. There's tons of archaeology that shows this. I want to show you just a few pictures real quickly. The first one is from an excavation of Jericho. So it's kind of hard to see in this picture, but archaeologists have dug up this old city, and they've dated it to about 1400 BC. And there are layers in this picture that, again, are hard to tell if you don't know what you're looking for, but there's debris layers and burn layers where archaeologists have figured out there used to be a city there, and it had really big walls around it, and then some calamity hit the city, and the walls fell, and the entire city burned to the ground, just like is described in the text of Joshua from the Old Testament. I want to show you another picture. This is called the Tell Dan inscription, not because anyone told Dan something, but it's just this, we have some lights that went out, but it's just this inscription that comes from this pillar that's been dated to the 9th century BC. And in this, on this pillar, it talks about the house of David in Israel. And it describes this house of David, which refers to the dynasty of David, King David, just like it's recorded in the book of 1 and 2 Samuel, in that text in the Old Testament. Or here's another one, last one I'll show you. This is from the Annals of Tiglath-Pileser III, which is the Assyrian king in the 8th century BC. And so these are documents from his historical records, and on this is an inscription that describes the king of Israel and how the Assyrian nation attacked the king of Israel, and it names the king of Israel and how he killed that king, and then he placed a new king on the throne of the nation of Israel, and it matches the exact account that we get in the text of 2 Kings in the Bible. Now, I could go on, and some of us would love it, and most of us would get really bored with all this kind of archaeology. But basically, there's all kinds of archaeology that shows that lots of parts of the Old Testament, and even more parts of the New Testament, because those are newer and there's more things to show there, are very historically accurate and very reliable in terms of their trustworthiness. But admittedly, I've left out the miracles. Because there are parts of the Bible, it's not the whole Bible, it's not even most of the Bible, but there are some stories in the Bible that are really miraculous and seem strange and like, how could that happen? And then even more importantly, we need to go back to those four books about Jesus' life, these gospel accounts that describe what he said and describe what he did and talk about some things that he did that are pretty unbelievable. In fact, they describe how he died and then he rose from the grave. And those are central and those are pivotal because ultimately, if those books aren't true, if they're not reliable, if they're not historically trustworthy, well, then the rest of the Bible, it's just interesting reading, right? But if those four accounts are true, if those things really did happen, well, then that changes everything. And so we began last week by asking this question, how historically reliable, how trustworthy are these four books about Jesus' life? And we said there's a couple of things that we want to keep in mind whenever we talk about this, two important principles. Number one, when it comes to history, we make decisions based on evidence, not proof. We can't prove anything from history with certainty. We can just look at the evidence and we make decisions based on that. And the second, we make conclusions based on what's probable, not what's possible. And I didn't just make these principles up. This is what all historians use. In fact, I was sitting in a graduate level class at the University of Denver this past week, this academic research secular institution, talking about history and how we understand things from the past. And we talked about these very principles that sociologists and historians use to determine, are ancient artifacts and are ancient manuscripts historically reliable? And these are the things that historians look at. And when we looked at these, last week we looked at the actual manuscripts that have been found of the New Testament and the gospel accounts. And we put up this big chart, and we basically concluded, or I tried to show you that we should conclude, that compared to other ancient documents, Caesar, Tacitus, Josephus, Suetonius, Homer, Plato, Aristotle, compared to all of these, we have more ancient manuscripts. They're better preserved, they're better kept, and they're closer to the original documents of the gospel accounts in the New Testament than anything else that we have from ancient history. So when you just look at these ancient documents that we have, and you just look at this one slice of evidence, it's pretty overwhelming. If you accept anything else about Roman history or Greek history, anything else from the ancient world, then you've got to give a lot of credence and you've got to give a lot of trustworthiness to these four gospel accounts. Now, there are a few more questions we need to explore today because last week we didn't actually talk about the content of these four gospel accounts. And so the question is, what are they really claiming about Jesus? What are they saying about him? Are they consistent in what they say? Are there contradictions in what they say? What do we know about the authors? The guys that wrote these books, I mean, are they credible? Can we actually believe them? Or is it possible that they just made these stories up, or they embellished them, or they added legends to these stories? Now, here's the situation. Remember, there's these four books. They're called Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And two of them were written by eyewitnesses. We're pretty sure, we think, Matthew and John, who were part of the original 12 disciples of Jesus. So they wrote things that they actually saw and experienced themselves. And then the other two books were reportedly written by Mark and Luke, who were not original 12 disciples. But we know that they interviewed people and they talked to people who were. In fact, Luke, remember, says he investigated everything. He talked to eyewitnesses. He talked to people so that he could put forward a clear and orderly account. So two eyewitness accounts of Jesus' life and then two accounts from people that interviewed other people. And that's the four gospels that we have. Now, the question is, how did we get these four books? And there are three broad theories that we want to look at tonight. The first is this, collective fabrication. That simply means that four guys, or four people, or four groups of people got together and they decided to make this story up. Or they decided to embellish the story, but they added stories, they created stories, they fabricated these stories about this guy named Jesus, and they did it all together. That's collective fabrication. The second theory would be individual fabrication, that there's four different people who decided to make up stories about Jesus or embellish them or make them different, and they all four wrote these different four accounts, and then all four of them later got put together and contributed to this idea about this guy named Jesus. So that's individual fabrication. And the last one would be individual historical record, that there's actually four different people that wrote down historical accounts about what they saw or what was told to them about what really happened. Now, instead of examining, and there's sub-theories and there's sub, kind of elements to each one of these, but these are the broad three theories about how these books came into being. And instead of examining every single one, I want to try an experiment. I want to come at this from a different angle instead of looking at which one might be correct. I want to ask a question. If Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John really did individually, the third theory there, write down four different historical accounts about this guy named Jesus and his life, if they really did that, what would you expect those books to look like? In other words, if four different people write about one event or one thing from four different angles and their historical records of what actually happened, what would you expect those accounts to look like? And what you'll find is that whenever different people tell the same story, there's a few things that are true about what they say and how they say it. And to illustrate this, I actually talked to four different people this past week about an event that they all shared in together. Stephen Redden, Dan Snyder, good-looking John Seward, and Alex Cady all went on a trip together last year. I didn't know much about the trip. I just knew they took this trip together. And so I talked to each one of them individually. I didn't even tell the other that I would be talking to them. And I asked each of them to describe to me this trip that they went on last year. And here's what each one of them said. It was this trip to go see some spring training baseball games. And the first person I talked to was Stephen. And here's what Stephen said. And I'm just giving you the bullet points. I wrote it down exactly, so I'm not giving you everything he said, but here's the main things he told me. He said, there was a 14-hour drive in the minivan. We watched three baseball teams and one basketball game. He said the trip was more fun than the destination, so that actually the trip down there and the trip back was more fun than actually what they did when they got there. We listened to music and we watched movies along the way. And then he said, I really got to know the guys better and I had tons of fun on the trip. So that's Stephen's version of the story. Well, then I talked to John. And John let me know right off that at the time he was unemployed. And so he didn't have to take work off. He was really excited about that. And he wanted to get away from Denver. And that eating In-N-Out Burger was the main reason for the trip. And that he ate it five different times on the trip. And oh yeah, we watched two Rockies games. And then he said, I really got to know the guys better and I had lots of fun. So then I talked to Alex. And here's what Alex told me. He said three people went for spring training and one went for In-N-Out Burger. Who could that be? He said we watched the Rockies, the Dodgers, and the Cubs. Some new information. We ate at In-N-Out Burger maybe six or seven times in 3 days. There were great times with guys being guys. And then he told me a story that needed to be edited out of this presentation. And then he said it brought me closer to the other guys on the trip. Last, I talked to Dan. And here's what Dan said. He said there was a 13-hour road trip, and the best part was the trip itself. He said, we watched movies in the van, we took in two Rockies games, Stephen went to a Dodgers game, and then we all went to a Phoenix Suns basketball game. We ate In-N-Out Burger five times, and then he told me there was lots of live tweeting of this trip. And he was really excited about that part. And then he said, one of the most memorable parts of the trip was Alex got sick on the way home after eating Taco Bell. And that was really funny and really memorable, and he started telling me all about that. Now, obviously, some of these guys are lying, right? Because Dan said the trip took 13 hours, and Stephen said the trip took 14 hours. So which is it? Did it take 13 hours, or did it take 14 hours? John only mentioned the Rockies, but he didn't mention the other games. So did John not go to the other games? Did they all just go to the Rockies? Are the other guys lying about which games they went to? In-N-Out Burger was a big deal for three of these guys. Which makes me wonder, was Stephen on this trip? Because he did not mention In-N-Out Burger at all. I don't understand it. What's going on there? I'm not sure Stephen actually went on the trip. Now, Another thing that's funny is Dan's testimony about this trip, because he talked a lot about live tweeting to me, which nobody else mentioned. And then he told me one of the highlights of the trip, highlights, I guess, was Alex getting sick after Taco Bell, and that it was really memorable, but nobody else mentioned it. Alex himself did not even mention this part of the trip. So somebody's lying, right? I mean, Dan made that story up, didn't he? Or did it happen and nobody else? Like, what's going on here? Can we really believe any of these guys? I mean, did they really go on this trip? You see, what you find out whenever different people give different accounts of the same event is there's always a few things that are true about features of distinctive accounts. The first thing that's true is there's always a different emphasis. Some of the guys focused on the games they went to. Some of them focused on the road trip. Some of them focused on the food. There's different details that are told. Lots of different details in how they told me their stories. There's general agreement about the focus. All of them said it was a really fun trip, and one of the main things was getting to know the other guys better. But there's always apparent contradictions as well. How long was the trip? 13 hours? 14 hours? How many times did they eat at In-N-Out Burger? Was it 5 times? Alex said he thought it might be 6 or 7. How many games did they go to? Some mentioned different games, some mentioned different teams. There are a lot of apparent contradictions in their 4 different stories. Now, here's what's important about this exercise. What's so powerful and persuasive about the gospel accounts is that you see the same thing taking place. That how they relate their stories to us about Jesus have the same 4 features. You see, each one of them has a different emphasis. Matthew is Jewish. And his focus when he tells Jesus' story is to tell Jesus' story and let people know that Jesus is the Messiah that the Jewish people have been waiting for. So he tells us different parts of his story to help us understand that. Mark has a different goal. Mark actually is writing to an audience and a group of people who are going through a lot of persecution in their lives at the time and a lot of suffering. And so he highlights stories of persecution and suffering that Jesus is going through in his life. It's a way to say, don't worry, Jesus knows what you're going through and Jesus knows how you feel. Luke was not a Jew. Luke was a Gentile, and most of the people he was writing to were Gentiles as well. And he wasn't sure, or he was worried, if his audience thought that maybe they were outsiders to this early on Jewish faith. And so he highlights stories from Jesus' life where Jesus is interacting with outsiders, where Jesus is talking and ministering to women, where Jesus is healing people that are unclean, where Jesus is hanging out with people on the margins. Luke includes a lot of stories like that in his account. And then there's John. John is focused on demonstrating that Jesus is the long-awaited Son of God. And he's revealing that identity to us. And so John, in his account, goes through these 7 different miracles or 7 signs that he talked about that reveal Jesus' identity to us. And then he highlights 7 different I am statements that Jesus makes. I am the bread of life. I am the living water. I am the good shepherd. I am the door. I am the resurrection and life. He goes through these different statements to help us understand who Jesus really is. So they all have a different emphasis. They also include different details. If you read the 4 gospels side by side, you'll see that there's lots of different details. I won't go through all those, but they all have a general agreement about the focus as well. They're telling the story of Jesus. They could have written lots of accounts. They could have written lots of books. They could have told other things about the early Christian movement that they were a part of. But they decided to tell Jesus' story. And they focused on 3 years of Jesus' life. We don't have many stories about his childhood. In fact, somebody last week asked me, why don't we have any stories about Jesus when he was a kid? Did nobody know any of these stories? Was he a bad kid? And so those got cut out somewhere along the way. The truth is, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, they just weren't even concerned with that. They were focused on these years of his life where he was teaching, where he was healing, and they were ultimately focused on the most pivotal part of his life, the last week of his life when he came into Jerusalem, and then he was crucified, and then he rose from the grave. 1/3 of each of their books is focused on that week of Jesus' life. And so that's the focus of their accounts. But here's the last thing. The four gospel accounts also have apparent contradictions. If you read them side by side, you'll see that sometimes there's different wording. They'll tell the same story, and one person will say, Jesus said this, and someone will say, well, Jesus said this, and it'll be slightly different. Or sometimes the chronology is different. The way Luke tells his story has a different chronology than the way Mark tells his story. And I could go on and on. There's lots of apparent contradictions, but oftentimes what you'll see is they're not true contradictions. They're just apparent contradictions. It was acceptable in the ancient world to paraphrase someone else when you're saying, well, so-and-so said this. In fact, there weren't even quotation marks in Greek. So when you write down, here's what Jesus said, you weren't putting journalistic quotation marks, here's exactly what he said. You were just saying, this is generally what he said. I'm being faithful to what he said. I'm paraphrasing to you what he said. So if there's slight changes in wording, that was okay in the ancient world. And when you start looking at the chronology in Luke's book, Luke actually arranges all of his material thematically, not chronologically, whereas Mark does the opposite. So sometimes their order doesn't match up, but it's not a contradiction. It's just because they're presenting their material in different ways. And so oftentimes when you see these inconsistencies between the four different accounts, they're just apparent contradictions. But what happens if you come across some inconsistencies that can't be explained away very well? I mean, what happens when you get to the point and you say, well, Dan said 13 hours and Stephen said 14 hours. Well, which is it? Does that call into question the entire account? Well, actually, it doesn't. Actually, if anything, it lends authenticity to the entire account. Because if the four guys got together and were making this story up about Jesus, don't you think they would have made sure that everything lined up? Don't you would have think they would have made sure that none of their details were different, that they had their story straight and there weren't any inconsistencies? I mean, one of the most central parts of their books are the resurrection accounts. This is the defining moment of what they're writing about when Jesus rose from the dead. And if you read the four resurrection accounts, there's lots of inconsistencies. There's lots of different details that are included, different ones. And you start asking questions, what is going on here? And if anything, it actually lends authenticity to the accounts. Because if people got together later and they made this up, or if people got together later and Jesus really did die and he didn't rise from the grave, but they wanted him to rise from the grave, and so they added that part back in, don't you think they would have made sure that the foundation of their movement was built on this solid, tight, airtight account of what happened? And yet the fact that there are inconsistencies, the fact that there are these apparent contradictions in their four different stories, scholars will actually tell you it lends credibility and it lends authenticity to their accounts. Because anytime you have four different people tell the same story, they're going to have different emphases. They're going to share different details. They're going to have a general agreement about what they're talking about, but there's going to be apparent contradictions. So, if we go back to the three theories that we were looking at, collective fabrication, it doesn't seem to hold weight. It just doesn't seem like these accounts would have been made up, or they would have been embellished, or they would have been added later by church leaders, because you would have thought they would have dealt with all of these apparent contradictions and they wouldn't have put those in there. Individual fabrication, well, there's no way, there's really no scholars that believe that could have happened, because the four accounts do share so many of the similar stories. It seems crazy that four different people would just make up stories and they would all be so similar and share so many of the same dynamics about Jesus' life. What seems to be the best evidence, what seems to be the best conclusion, what the weight of the evidence seems to indicate, is that four different people really did write down what they saw or what was told to them, because it really did happen. Now, there's a few lingering questions. Maybe at this point you're still wondering, well, what do we know about the men who wrote these books and then even promoted them to others? And weren't they all biased? I mean, these were followers of Jesus, right? I mean, they're not neutral, objective reporters here. And what they reported is pretty unbelievable. They tell these stories that seem unbelievable to us, especially the story about Jesus rising from the dead. I mean, that's not in the realm of any of our experiences, is it? Has any of us ever seen someone rise from the dead? And so we read things like that, and we're left with the question, well, how can we believe what they say when what they report seems so unbelievable? Let me deal with the second two questions real quickly first. For starters, everybody is biased. We're all biased. There's no neutral, objective reporters. Everybody that gives an account of something is giving it from a biased position. And just because these men were followers of Jesus, it doesn't discredit what they wrote or what they said about him. And sure, they told stories of miracles and they told things that seem crazy, but just because I've never experienced a miracle and just because I've never seen somebody rise from the dead doesn't mean it didn't happen. I'll give you a quick example to illustrate this. If you asked almost any American in 1944 if it was possible for a nation dominated by Protestant Christians in the modern world to set out to exterminate an ethnic group of people by building gas ovens and then burning them to death, nobody would have believed you. Nobody would have thought that was possible. Anybody would have said, that's unfathomable. People don't do that. Nobody would ever do that. And yet the stories coming out of Germany from Jewish people were saying that's exactly what's happening over there. And the stories that many Jewish historians have given their lives to telling is what happened over there. And none of us stops and says, wait a second. Jewish people aren't really objective, neutral observers to this. I mean, they've got a stake in the game in these stories they're telling. Nobody says that. And nobody stops and says, well, it's unbelievable that 6 million people would die in these ovens. Like, I can't even fathom it. And so I just don't think it actually happened. We don't say that. Because the evidence suggests that the Holocaust really did happen. Even though the main people that tell the stories aren't objective reporters, and even though the story they're telling seems unfathomable and outside of our personal experience. And it's the same with the gospel writers. Just because they were followers of Jesus, and just because the stories they tell seem outside of our experience, doesn't mean they didn't really happen. Now, what do we know about these guys? Well, we know this. None of them ever got rich from what they wrote. None of them ever gained fame in their lifetime from what they wrote. They're famous now. We know their names, but they weren't famous then. None of them ever rose to Jewish leadership. None of them ever rose to Roman leadership. None of them had anything to gain by writing down these stories about Jesus' life. In fact, history tells us the opposite. That they were actually persecuted for what they wrote down. They were persecuted for the message that they spread. And most of them, other historical accounts and church traditions tell us, were violently and brutally killed for what they wrote down. Which means then we've got to come up with some theory as to why they would give their lives to something. If they made it up, if it wasn't true, if they were hanging around Jesus, but they didn't really see him rise from the dead, and it didn't happen, but they added that part later, why would they give their lives to spread this lie when they didn't gain anything from it, and when they actually died as a result of it? And it's not that they gave their lives for something they believed in, because people give their lives for things they believe in all the time. It's that they gave their lives for something they claim to have seen and experience themselves. And there's a pretty big difference. Now, I want to close by telling a story that I think illustrates this difference really well. It's a story from Jesus's life, and it's told to us in the book of John. You don't have to turn there. I'm just going to summarize it for the most part for you. But there's this man who's been born blind. So he's blind all his entire life. And Jesus comes along and he meets this man and he heals him one day. He gives him his sight. And it's so unbelievable that his friends and his neighbors and the people that have known him all his life, they don't believe it. They don't even think it's the same guy. Like, it just doesn't make sense to them. See, we tend to think, well, us modern people, we don't believe in miracles, but people back then, they believed in miracles all the time. No, they didn't. They knew. If you've been blind all your life, you don't just suddenly start seeing one day. So they don't believe this has happened. And yet, it seems like it happens. And so they go and they tell the Pharisees, who are the Jewish leaders of that day. And the Pharisees come along, and they say, what happened? Who healed you? And he says, well, this man named Jesus healed me. And it happened yesterday on the Sabbath. And the Pharisees go, aha, because they don't like Jesus. They're threatened by Jesus, and they want to discredit Jesus. And so they say, you know what? When somebody heals somebody else, that's like work. And you can't work on the Sabbath, because God tells us we can't work on the Sabbath, because they adhere to the letter of the law. And so they have this strange, twisted logic where they say, well, Jesus couldn't have actually healed you and made you see, because if he did it on the Sabbath. And we all know working on the Sabbath is wrong, and that's a sin. And nobody sent from God to be a healer of people would be doing sin like that. So Jesus couldn't have healed you, right? It's this kind of twisted logic. And so they actually go to his parents to discredit him in front of everyone. And they go to his parents and say, tell us the truth. What really happened? And what they want his parents to say is, well, he wasn't really born blind. He's actually been able to see. We've actually been putting on this charade all his life so he could sit around and beg and get money from people, but he wasn't really blind. Or maybe they want his parents to say, God healed him, but it wasn't Jesus, because they don't want to give Jesus credit for anything. Maybe God could have healed him, but Jesus couldn't have done it. And his parents don't want to get involved in the controversy, so they say to the Pharisees, you know what? Our son is old enough, so why don't you just go ask him what happened? So the Pharisees come back to the son. And in front of everyone else, they come back to the son. And this is where we pick up the story in John 9:24. This is what they say. A second time, they summoned the man who had been blind. Give glory to God by telling the truth, they said. We know this man, they're talking about Jesus here, is a sinner. In other words, set the record straight for everyone to hear. This account isn't believable, is it? It didn't really happen, did it? Jesus didn't really heal you, because we all know Jesus is a sinner. So just let's set the record straight. Tell everyone it didn't really happen. And look at how he answers in the next verse. He replied, whether he is a sinner or not, I don't know. But one thing I do know, I was blind, but now I see. It's like he's saying, look, I don't know what I believe about Jesus. You're asking me to like make theological statements. Was he the Messiah or not? Is he a sinner? Is he a pretender? Is he a, you know, can he heal? Can he do all these? I don't know. I'm not sure what I believe about him, but I can tell you this. Yesterday I was blind and now I can see. Like, it happened. So you figure out who you think he is, but all I can say is it actually happened. And you see the weight of that kind of statement? That's different from saying, here's what I believe about someone, but they're saying, and what he's saying, and what the disciples are saying. It's not about what we believe about Jesus. It's about what we're telling you actually happened. We saw him die on a cross, and we saw him heal people, and we saw him risen from the dead. And we're willing to give our entire lives, not just for something we believe. It's not about an idea or a philosophy or a concept. It's about what we actually saw and experienced in our lives. Now, what does that prove? Well, it doesn't prove anything, but it's evidence. It's evidence that maybe what they really did see happened. Maybe it really is historically trustworthy. Maybe we really can trust that all the things they said Jesus said, he did say. And all the things they said Jesus did, he really did do. Now, if you're here tonight and you're a follower of Jesus, I hope this is comforting to you. I hope this is reassuring. I hope this helps when you're going through difficult times or you're having doubts or you're not sure what you believe, that you can hang on to this and say, God has left me ways to trust in what he tells me about himself and what he tells me about what Jesus has done. Maybe for you, the best response to all of this evidence and to all of this thinking tonight is just to worship God more for who he is. But if you're here tonight and you'd say, well, I'm not really sure I'm a follower of Jesus yet. I'm not really sure I can fully buy this yet. I want to close by challenging you ever so slightly. And I just want to ask you one question. If you're not there, if you're at a place where you say, I'm just not sure I'm ready to make that leap of faith yet, here's the challenge I would ask you. What more do you need from God? What more could he have done to bring you to the place where you could take a step of faith in him? Because it's not like Jesus was doing all the things he did in some backroom alley somewhere and nobody actually saw it. He was doing all of these things in public. He was doing all of these things in front of hundreds of people. He healed hundreds of people. He taught to thousands of people. And then he was crucified in Jerusalem, the biggest city in Israel at the time, on the busiest day of the year, the day before Passover, where thousands of people walked by and saw him hanging on a cross. And then hundreds of people saw him risen from the dead after that. And then a bunch of people told stories about it. And then four of them actually wrote those stories out. Not just one person, four of them. We have more accounts about Jesus than we do about Alexander the Great. And then those stories and those accounts were better produced, better preserved, and better maintained than any other historical documents from ancient history. So that here we are 2,000 years later, every single one of us would have the best possible chance at being able to trust what they actually do say about Jesus. So the question is, what more could God have done? How much more could he have met us? It's not like he met us halfway. It's like he said, I'm going to give you everything you need to make the best decision. It's still going to be a leap of faith. But it's not a blind leap of faith. It's not an uninformed leap of faith. I'm going to give you enough evidence so that it's like you're standing on the high dive. And I'm saying you've got all the evidence you need to jump, but you're still going to have to jump. And so the question I'd ask is, what's holding you back from jumping? And maybe it's just because ultimately you're scared. And I would say, you know what? That scares all of us. All of us are scared when we have to take a leap of faith and trust in God. And so I would just challenge you tonight to go for it. That's what trust is all about. Take the jump of faith. God doesn't ask us to do anything that we're not able to do. He meets us more than halfway. In fact, you could even say he's been pursuing every single one of us all of our lives. And so if you want to take the jump, if you want to take the leap of faith, I'll take it with you. And there's tons of people here in this community of faith that'll take it with you. That's what this community of faith is about. It's about us taking steps of faith together. And so maybe tonight is a night for you to say, yeah, I'm going to do it. I'm going to put my trust in God. I'm going to trust that these accounts really do mean what they say. And I'm going to trust he really did send his son to show me his love and to give me the kind of new life that I really do desire. Let me pray. Father God, I just pray for every single person in this room here, myself included. My hunch is that all of us have areas of our lives that we're holding back. All of us have areas of our hearts and our lives where we're just scared to take a leap of faith. For some of us, maybe it's with money. For some of us, maybe it's with our jobs. For some of us, maybe it's with our marriage. For some of us, maybe it's with the person that we hope to be married to. Maybe it's with our desire to have kids. Maybe it's with our kids themselves. Maybe it's with habits, maybe it's with attitudes, maybe it's with forgiveness, whatever it is, maybe it's simply with you. Give us the boldness, give us the courage to step out tonight and trust that even in the face of our fear, that's where you meet us with open arms. And that's where you find us. And that's where you meet our faith with your faithfulness. And we come to know you as our Heavenly Father who truly loves each and every one of us. We pray this in your name. Amen.